We're right for the day. You never go to the camp?
No, only weekend. Is it well for you?
It was good. She got into this, it's like the latest. First week, they're both in San Juan's latest in Ohio. Very narrow, your candidates, the calls. I'll bring up about 2 percentage points, which I know you are McGovern, pardon. A lot of that votes are not counted because of the Tahoe County. Federal judge changed the law there, but the poll was 5.5 hours afterward because of the veggie jobs. Jackson has dropped out as a result of Ohio's still a candidate, but not in any more primary. Just did last week, McGovern the better than he was expected, yes. Of course, we have over 50 colleges in Ohio, which could help. Well, we would like to get the update, Mr. Matamore. I just want to urge the local leaders today. We're just providing this to the benefit of the leaders because the Admiral has been less on the hill, and we want to keep regions on this situation, a bipartisan conference. About getting us group together, and I'm sure we'll do that, of course, we had Admiral go, and Admiral, anybody call you, and he'll be welcome to read. Yes, sir. If you want to give us full water, I'll just test, please.
I'll already done that.
And your best.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, it's bad and good.
Yes, sir. Well, Mr. President, gentlemen, I'm going to put the operation in South Vietnam in perspective. I'd like to just very quickly run over the series of events that have occurred since the beginning of what we call the dry season, when it became evident that the North Vietnamese were going to, in effect, posture themselves so that they could make a do-or-die effort in South Vietnam. We just want to watch this very carefully. You know, I have a chart of Indochina. We had indications, for instance, that the 308th Division moved down and positioned itself just north of the DMZ. Simultaneously, they brought in a large amount of long-range artillery, 130mm artillery. They also concentrated a great number of surface air missiles just north of the DMZ. At the same time, they brought the 304th Division around here into the Chupon area, where it could make a move to the eastward into the Quang Tri province, and the 324th Regiment down here, so that it was focused on Hue, which is the big city in military Chupon. Furthermore, we noticed the 320th Division, which also came from the central part of North Vietnam, come into this area, which we call the Highlands, and position itself here in the triangular area against the Dako, Khantum, Plateau area. At the same time, the North Vietnamese had three divisions in Cambodia, the 5th, 7th, and 9th, which have were the ones, of course, which were involved in the cross-border operation about 2 years ago, and they were more or less focused into military Region 3 against the generally of the Tainan area. So it was quite evident that they were, in fact, going to make an all-out effort. They had two divisions here in the Plain de Jars area operating against the Laotians, and this meant then that at that point they only had one division left in North Vietnam, if they in fact committed all the divisions I mentioned into South Vietnam. The facts are that they have now committed the 325th Division, which was their last main force division, and this morning we have tenuous indication, but not yet substantiated, that the 312th Division, which is one of the divisions in Laos, is now being pulled back and moved down in this direction also. At the same time, we noticed rather significant increase in airfare activity for the North Vietnamese, and the sense that they were operating with more frequency south of the 20th parallel, and they were making excursions into Laos along this particular part of the border, where we were conducting intermission operations against the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And, and so doing, they brought the 308th division as well as a regiment of tanks. And, these units were equipped with some very modern equipment, equipped by the soldiers, of course, and I'll show you some pictures of those units and those, items of equipment in just a minute. When the, North Vietnamese made this attack, they did it under cover of very, very bad weather, which is, prevalent in that particular area that time of year. And consequently, they had, several days wherein they could, operate, freely, primarily against the 3rd Army Division, without any, air cover being provided for the South Vietnamese. Now, the South Vietnamese, of course, had watched all this movement very carefully, and they did have contingency plans for reinforcements, which included their Marine Division from the Saigon area up to Military Region 1. They took certain elements of the Air 1 Brigade and put in this area in Military Region 2, and they had a plan for taking the 21st Division from Military Region 4 and putting it up here in this general area to Military Region 3. And subsequently, all of those plans have, in fact, been executed. Now, let me turn to region by region and tell you essentially what has happened so far and update the situation as it stands this morning. First, this is the Military Region 1. And here you have the DNC here. And as I said before, the 3rd Division of the Army was disposed right behind the DMZ, and the 1st Division was disposed around Hue, which is, of course, a very valuable point so far as the South Vietnamese is concerned, and the 2nd Division was down in the southern part of the Military Region 1. I have indicated here the range of the surface air missiles, which were located north of the DMZ, and which were used against aircraft, U.S. and South Vietnamese aircraft operating in this area. You can see then that the aircraft that were operating in support of the 3rd Division were constantly subjected to firings across the DMZ. Now, since 30 March, and counting all of the air activity in South Vietnam and North Vietnam, North Vietnamese has fired over 700 surface air missiles. 125 of these missiles were fired north of the DMZ down into this particular area against aircraft operating in support of this invasion. Initially, the 3rd Division fell back from these positions just south of the DMZ and took the position here from Don Ha to along the Qua Viet River. There's a river that runs right in here, and then established the line more or less down this way. Subsequent to that time, over the weekend, as you know, the Don Ha, which was the northwest strong point here, received 4,900 rounds of 122-millimeter and 130-millimeter artillery, which is perhaps one of the heaviest shellings in any point had received in this war. As a result of that, the 3rd Division fell back. They blew the bridge just north of Don Ha and fell back to a position just north of Quang Tri. Well, a series of assaults and attacks on this particular point that occurred, as you know from the press, they then withdrew from Quang Tri and now are in the project of setting up a line which has a strong point anchored here on five, what we call Proxy Board Base Nancy, which is in the western tip of this area. Now, so you find that this point in this particular area, a situation wherein the 1st Division is disposed around Way. It has been devoting its efforts towards forming an effort on the part of the 324B Division to attack Way from this direction. And we have a 5 support base, Birmingham, which is the outpost, so to speak, along this one avenue of approach. And the 1st Division has been operating now for some time against efforts made by this 324B Division to move in here. This division has suffered very heavy losses. throughout this operation. The third division, which was the one that has been bearing the brunt of the attack all the time, has not been quite so well. They're in a position where they're going to require some reforming and replacements before they can be effective. So we have essentially on the spot operating the Marines and the 3rd Division. The 3rd Division is, as well as the armored regiment that the South Vietnamese had in that area, have lost a significant amount of equipment, and we have not taken steps to ensure that that's replaced at this rapid rate as they can reinstall it with the training personnel to operate. We're taking extraordinary action to replace this equipment. Now, so you have essentially this morning a situation with the line running around about like that, with the 1st Division holding firm against this effort, and with activity now taking place to establish a line here anchored on Fox Fort Nancy right in this position, right here. Now, just south of Military Region 1, you have Da Nang. Da Nang, of course, is used by the South Vietnamese as a harbor, and also both the South Vietnamese and the U.S. forces operate aircraft from Da Nang. We actually expect from time to time, and have had already, attacked by fire with rockets and mortar fire in this area, and I expect that during the forthcoming week we'll get some more of that. There's also been some activity down south here of Da Nang by one unit of North Vietnamese forces, but so far it has not developed as a significant threat. It is in this area that the 196th U.S. Brigade is located for the express purpose of protecting this activity that's going on here in Da Nang. So much for the 1st Division, for the 1st Military Region. This is where most of the activity is taking place. This is where we have the most serious situation. This is where the North Vietnamese have most ready access from a logistic point of view as well as a replacement point of view. I want to emphasize that this is not a one-sided affair. We have intercepts indicating, among other things, that the North Vietnamese are taking 2,000 wounded back by this route. Forward air control aircraft has observed many trucks going north with wounded in the trucks. And since we have laid on such a heavy air effort in this particular area, it's obvious that they have sustained extreme numbers of casualties in some cases. We had an indication, for instance, that in the case of the 304 Division, that two of these regiments had been hit heavily and to the point that they are frankly ineffective, and that might cause them to have to reorganize themselves. Of course, they, as I said before, make an all-out effort. They've pushed down replacement personnel, and they will try to revitalize these units. But nevertheless, their losses, both in equipment and in personnel, have been extremely heavy. For instance, in the case of the tanks, I might just mention that they had a regiment of tanks of about 160. Subsequently, they reinforced these tanks. They've been using tanks for the first time down in this area here and inside this area. And from all reports, it appears that they lost something on the order of 300 tanks. Of course, this is subject to confirmation later. You have to recognize that since most of our air effort is being conducted in enemy territory, it's difficult for us to get immediate bomb damage assessment. In other words, we've got to move in there in order to get precise pictures, and they use the lag significantly. But nevertheless, tanks have been destroyed. For instance, right here, only this morning, when the North Vietnamese attacked the Marines, the South Vietnamese Marines, and lost 10 tanks and 73 personnel. Here is the most difficult area that we have to contend with at the moment. The problem, as I said before, is to establish this line in some way that it can be held so that the air targets will develop. and we can work on them. Now, so much for military reason one. Let me quickly go through the others, and then I would like to talk about some of the U.S. efforts in terms of air and in terms of gunfire support. First, there is military reason two, which if you want to reorient yourself, is this area right here, what we call the highlands or the tripod area where Cambodia, Laos, and South Vietnam come together. As I said, the North Vietnamese brought down the 320th Division. It has been also subject to situation or attrition, you might say. And I think that, my personal think that their first intent was to kick off down here some time ago. But they simply could not get sponsored. The North Vietnamese will not move until they get everything in place just so before they'll make that first move. And so, due to some of the losses they sustained here, they did not make a move. Now, they have moved out now and occupied a place called Dak Tho, and they're moving south to the point where the South Vietnamese are setting up a defense line just north of a place called Con Tu. And the next place south of it is Play Tu. Now, Play Tu is a larger city, of course, and there's a highway which runs from Play Tu straight east over here to the ocean. And the problem is to we'll keep that highway open. That's where the Koreans have been participating during the past week. That highway is open. There have been several large civilian convoys going into Play Tu, so there's no food problem so far as the civilians are concerned in that particular area. While I'm in military reason too, I should say that again so far, the enemy has not made that major move, but we do anticipate that the enemy, they're going to make a major move against Con Tu. Also of some concern is the fact that over here in what is called Binh Dinh Province, which is on the water, on the ocean right here, where the North Vietnamese have maintained units for a long, long time, and have had a DC infrastructure, they have been taking action against some of the district headquarters, and this is an area that we've got to very carefully watch and cause some concern in the sense that it permits the North Vietnamese to revitalize their infrastructure in that particular place. We are watching that, and we have been giving them air support and some ship support. They have had to withdraw from some of the district headquarters, and the North Vietnamese are pretty well infiltrated right in this little area right here. So, I'll leave military reason too by saying that we are expecting a kickoff against Con Tu any time. We are looking for that. Now go to military reason three, which is received so much publicity in terms of Anlock. Anlock is a little town here that's due north of Saigon. And the North Vietnamese moved out the bridge with their 5th Division. As I told you, they had 3 divisions in Cambodia in this area here. They moved out first and late siege, you might say, to Anlock. And perhaps Anlock has received about as much artillery and mortar fire as any small town or city in this particular war also. Overall, today, Anlock is still in the hands of the South Vietnamese. They have expanded their perimeter. They are still receiving attacks by fire, particularly at night. However, we have seen no tanks in the vicinity of Anlock, despite the fact that initially there were quite a few tanks in the area. And so obviously the North Vietnamese have withdrawn those tanks that did survive, and this doesn't mean that they might not try to use them again. But in any event, the tank activity there has been rather light or non-existent in recent days. In Military Region 3, the South Vietnamese have the 18th, the 25th, and the 5th Divisions. And they have one airborne brigade as a reserve, which more or less defends Saigon itself. When this operation commenced, they took a division from the 4th floor area and moved it up in along this road here to reinforce the other action that's taking place here. In addition to these three divisions, the 5th, 7th, 9th, the North Vietnamese also over all the way from Illinois. And a independent regiment called the 271st Regiment. This regiment is operated right here, and in a series of fights over the weekend, they lost several hundred men. And we know that they are ineffective for the moment. Again, we would expect the North Vietnamese to send in killers to withdraw and try to fill them up and get them going again. Turning to the Delta area, military region 4, which is the most heavily populated, as you know. Here the action has been simply a series of very sharp but small encounters between the regional and popular forces throughout the kind of assault and tell problem throughout this particular area. There's been some SAPA action and so on. This morning, the action during the past 24 hours is very light here. The action in military region 3 is very light, except for some shouting and landlocks. Actually, military region 2 is relatively light, except, as I said, the North Vietnamese forces are trying to position themselves for an attack on Con 2. In military region 1, the problem, as I said, is to establish these lines in the north. Now, let me talk a little bit about some of our action with our own forces. As you gentlemen know, when this thing kicked off, the President directed that we augment both the air and the sea forces. We did this by sending additional carriers and destroyers, and as well as B-52s and F-4s. So far as the destroyers have been concerned, they have been operating in two areas. We've had about 11 destroyers right here just south of the DMZ. Assisting in the land battle, and they have also been operating along the coast of North Vietnam. Here you see, same as this red line marks the range of the area which they can, in fact, cover. Some of the destroyers have been hit with fine lines, despite the fact that they received large shore battery fire. The damage to them has been very light. We did have, for the first time in this war, one destroyer hit by a very small bomb delivered by MiG-17. But aside from that, they have simply been subject to attacks by PD boats, which they have defeated quite handily. There's been no damage from PD boats, and they have been firing a very large number of rounds at primarily the Pacific targets. The air effort has also taken place in north of the DMZ as well as south of the DMZ, and we have been using air in military regions 2, 3, 4, and 1, as well as in North Vietnam. Mr. President, I think that just about finishes the situation as it stands today. I'll be very happy to ask questions. I just covered it very quickly. Mr. Gilbert,
why don't you speak to it in perspective, give an idea, and say the number of surgeons fly, say, like yesterday, maybe before?
Yes, sir. Well, combined with, if you combine the South Vietnamese effort with the U.S. efforts, we've been flying something around 1,200 sorties total. This counts attack sorties as well as support sorties that are necessary in order to manage the whole air effort. We have reports
that the sorties are moving up to the 20th parallel in North
Vietnam. Yes, sir. So far as the action in North Vietnam is concerned, we've had two carriers that have been operating continuously, and then also an aircraft from the 7th Air Force. This right here is a place called Don Hoi, where they ship in a lot of material, and then they have a highway running down into the Ho Chi Minh Trail. We've had several attacks on large numbers of trucks, supplies, POL. Yesterday, right at this point right here, we attacked, I think it was 128,000 50-gallon fuel drums, or something like that. It was well over millions of gallons, and it all went up. We had smoke up to 10,000 feet. There have been attacks against Dan Hoa, attacks against men, and attacks against oil, and we have been conducting point attacks on point targets, such as bridges and so on, and on mobile targets. In other words, the aircraft is conducting armed reconnaissance, primarily aimed at stopping the flow of supplies and working on that final 325th division that's been trying to move down there. But generally speaking, we've had about 200 sorties in this general area during the last 3 or 4 days. And south, we've had something like anywhere from 340 down to 200 or so in military region 1, and then somewhere like 130 or 40 in military regions 2 and 3, and about 40 or 50 sorties in military region 4. At the same time, the B-52 has concentrated their effort in military region 1 and 3, to less degree in 2. But this distribution of strikes, of course, is controlled by the field commanders in, according to the typical operations of the moment.
The air strikes now are predominantly in bases of the battleships and the navigators and fleets. That's where they are. Needed the most rather than
that's correct.
In other words, I think as far as the B-52s are concerned, it was a point that I wish to make that have no illusions about why the B-52s are not heading further north at the moment. They're being used where they're most where they're needed most, which is in the areas of battles for the general agents. Is that I understand?
Yes, sir, that's quite correct. The resources are concentrated depending on the identification of the targets and the tempo of the land action as it exists at the time. And so this is kind of played like an accordion, back and forth. Where one day you'll see a main emergency, the next day it may be at another point. But that's just normal management of the resources.
You spend a moment on that. It's a question I'm sure others have. I would encourage you to spend a moment on those divisions. Third division, as I understand, that's the one that is having the greatest difficulty.
Yes, sir.
But in terms of the analysis of the divisions,
the third division was a new division. It was formed in anticipation of more ground activity this year as the U.S. forces were withdrawn. And it was at a readiness date of 1 April, and this action really started on 30 March. So it had just reached its readiness date when it became involved in this action. As I said, when it was faced with this massive move, which had not been conducted before by the North Vietnamese, in the sense that they used a very large number of tanks, a very large number of motorized vehicles and motorized air defense units, the 3rd Division fell back in the south of the Guadalquivir River and then fought there until this weekend. But it was one of the newer divisions. The 1st Division is a division that's been in this area from the outset. And it is one of the best divisions, if not the best division, that the South Vietnamese have.
Who's the commander of the 1st?
The commander of the 1st Division is General Fuzo, THU.
Who was General Lam?
General Lam is commander of the entire military reach. See, there's one. There's General Lam is in row one and twos and two men's in three and front is in four, but they will there may be some mischief taking place in this particular command structure.
The general speaking, I don't say that the enemy is still conducting an all-out offensive. Anticipate that there will be continued
had in mind that that events cannot continue indefinitely.
That's correct. Now, what we're really talking about is the will and termination of the South Beach Committee. Now, we know that the North Beach Committee have engaged what they call a logistic offensive. In other words, they have taken extraordinary efforts to move supplies south in order to sustain this type of operation. And it's doubtful if they can sustain this tempo very long. As I mentioned, had they fired 4,900 rounds into Don Cobb. But at the same time, I think as they move down here, they're going to find it more difficult to operate their motorized equipment, get fuel of these tanks. These big T-54 tanks only get takes about 18 gallons, I think, for 1 mile. And so they're going to have difficulty distributing their fuel. So our problem is to get the South Beach Committee's in position, and also their problem is to exercise and demonstrate the will and determination to take advantage of the situation. But obviously, as the enemy moves in further and further, their logistics problems as well as their military problems, those combat problems become greater, because to take them down in this area, because this is more or less open, and as they move down further, this leaves more area of their LOCs to be attacked.
Tom, could you give us some ideas, your reaction, the reaction of General Abrams as to the conduct of the South Vietnamese so far? Have they done about what you expect them to do, or are they better than you thought, or worse?
Well, I think you're saying that some units have done better and some have done worse, John. Some have been spying. And that's about what one might expect. For instance, in the headlock, where we were concerned about the ability to hold, they finally routed, and despite very heavy casualties and very heavy damage to the city itself, and as I said, they have managed to extend the perimeter. So I think that you have to say that it's a spy. This is one of the problems, again, getting back to will and determination. I think they have training, and they have the equipment that, in most cases.
Well, they've shown no great desire to counterattack up there, and that's one of the failings of the South Vietnamese units through the years. Is this likely to continue, or are they not counterattacking because they don't have the assets?
Well, I think they haven't counterattacked because one of the reasons is that the North Vietnamese, as I said, having committed that total inventory of resources, has been keeping heavy pressure on them. And there's no question about it in my mind that the North Vietnamese, this is in place of delivery, place themselves in a position of do or die. I think the fact that they committed the 325th Division, and now there's some indication that they, which we have been watching, that they, one of the divisions over here has come off is moving down this way. They're shooting the work, so to speak. And so they have kept the very maximum pressure and very maximum firepower. And the Soviets have provided the North Vietnamese with what one might call invasion type equipment. And if you're interested, I have some. Let me see the photos there.
Could you say that the lack of leadership, certainly the leadership
has improved itself? I think, Les, that you can always put your bank on the leadership. By and large, that's where the problem is. That's where we had to start from scratch in South Vietnam to build up the leadership. That's the most difficult problem. You can always say it's leadership.
Is there any evidence of a shortage of logistics capability from the North Vietnamese as of yet, caused by the airstrikes on the supply line?
Sure, we've had isolated cases where they, for instance, have exhausted their fuel or exhausted their ammo. I think it's more, at the moment, a problem of distribution rather than because they are facing this problem, and that they're using so much motorized equipment of having to carry the fuel and they amble along with them. And so they've had, as I say, a problem with distribution. We've had reports of ammo shortage. For instance, as I mentioned, the SA-2 missiles, we've had the indication that some of the missile launches up here are out of missiles and things of this kind. But here again, this has been spiked.
Now, what effect is the weather likely to have, both on air? I mean, we're about in a change in the seasons here.
Yes, as I think everyone knows, the Aramite Mountains run about so. And during the northeast monsoon, which is just shifting to the southwest monsoon, the winds blow across the Gulf of Tonkin and pick up the moisture and stack it up against these mountains. And that's what was happening when they actually made the move across on the 30th, and why you had this low, heavy overcast. Now it's shifting around so the flow comes from the northwest, I mean southwest, and picks up the moisture in the Gulf of Sound and backs it up on this side and starts raining in Laos. And so the rains are beginning. I had to talk to a boat on my telephone. It's seen several trucks bogged down in the mud. So it's just the beginning of the rains on the southwest side of these mountains. For instance, down in this particular area, it gets unusually sticky and gummy. And the weather has a different effect on different areas. So far as the logistics is concerned, of course, the easiest problem that the North Vietnamese have is just south of the DMZ because they have this is short of time. And the weather now, fortunately, is from a flying point of view, on this side of the mountains, is very good.
Admiral, what about the logistics problems for the South Vietnamese? I think there's a real capacity for the North to come through on the second floor area and from Kantung to Vinh Dinh. That's a real possibility. If they cut Vietnam in two there, will it create logistics problems up around Lake? Or do you rely primarily on the sea there?
No, I don't think it would cause logistics problems coming around Lake. I know that the papers have had headlines on two occasions they're going to cut South Vietnam in two along Highway 19, but I don't think that that's the biggest difficulty that the closure of the 19 makes it difficult to peace between the civilians and so on in the Play 2 area. And not that it, in effect, cuts off the supplies for military purposes up north of that area. The Pan Trang province is of concern from a long-range point of view in the sense that it has been a soft spot with respect to the, pacification program, and it simply sets that back. That's the more concern than the direct military impact.
Or in the major encounter tool that you anticipate is likely to carry right on through?
Well, I would hope not. I think what they're trying to do is to probably, take two or three provincial capitals. And this is why they have focused on Kantung and Quang Tri and so on. But I know they're just dissipating on their art. I think the art has a couple of capabilities to prevent that from happening.
Admiral, there have been some reports of NVA divisions poised, and I think the period of the area of Cambodia. Is there any possibility of a threat developing on the city of Saigon itself because of action that's taking place there?
Yes, there's a possibility. They're not divisions so much. As I mentioned, there were two regiments right here, 271st and the 24th. And the 271st, though, has been very heavily mauled. Now, I mentioned the fact that we haven't seen any tanks in Anlock in quite a while. You always have the possibility of them trying to do a flanking move with you and come in that direction. On the other hand, the South Vietnamese do have four divisions in this area. Obviously, plus that M1 brigade right here. So it depends on the army. They have the capability if they want to stand them off. Also, the further south you go, of course, again, along with the logistics lines of the North Vietnamese are extended. But this is being watched, but we don't see any indication of such a thing to developing at the moment. Now, it's true that they have interstate Highway 1, which runs from Saigon to Phnom Penh in Cambodia. It's all due to be said in addition to that particular highway. But that does not affect Saigon from a logistics point of view, of course. It does, to some degree, affect Phnom Penh.
Admiral, in a briefing a week ago, the day after Kissinger pointed out, I believe, that of the 43 provincial capitals, we had lost none. However, there's likely that the two or three would fall shortly. Now, how does that compare with our situation today?
Well, we lost one.
Just one.
See, the other three provincial capitals, and in the treaty, Dr. Kissinger, unfortunately, too prophetic. The two that he indicated is in breeding about football with Quantry and Kanton. Quantry has lost Kanton as an investiture. And Lock at that time, of course. But these towns that you read about that fall, and just keeping that perspective, I mean, this is a rather enlightenment. And it isn't the capitals, but it's what happens to the men and the divisions that get those on both sides. As far as the district capitals are concerned, there are 43. One has fallen. Another country is in danger. What will happen to the others? Of course, we cannot. That's what the situation is today. I think far more important than the district capitals, although there's some more of them, of course, is the capability, as the Admiral was suggesting, of both sides in terms of the South Vietnamese retaining their morale and spirit and so forth on the defense. And the North Vietnamese to have the capability to logistically and otherwise to maintain the offense. Now, this battle has been going on for almost 5 weeks. Having gone on that long, the North Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese have their problems because, as a change from the North Vietnamese, except for the 1st Division and 2 or 3 others, don't have a lot of battle-scarred veterans and leaders who have been tested in battle. The North Vietnamese are led by, and of course they suffer enormous casualties, but they're led by pretty skilled, effective leaders. They also, we have to candidly realize that they, and this is no discredit to our program of the Vietnamization program, because it was set up not for the purpose of offense, but defense. The North Vietnamese have bigger tanks, bigger guns, better supply for the offensive. And consequently, the South Vietnamese take the 3rd Division, a division that was totally new, with two leadership and the rest. And as it comes the most experienced, best part of the North Vietnamese division, very close to their supply lines, with the big Soviet tanks, big Soviet guns, both of which can outrank anything we do in South Vietnamese. It's a pretty awesome thing. Now, that's where the air guard is, and what's the equalizer? One would say, well, South Vietnamese have air guard, and let me say that if we didn't have the air guard, we'd be out of them, but they've got it finished now. The air power is not a total equalizer, but it is a considerable one. Basically, our air power, the attack air and the B-52, is an equalizer for the North Vietnamese superiority in tanks and guns. So our air power is being used to neutralize those tanks and guns and so forth. And it has to be used, and it will continue to be used. I think if I could put it in perspective, because it's very important to you know both in my speech a week ago and speaking again in Dallas, supplies to be taken. officer was part of that. As far as how the battle was going, there have been some losses on the top of the enemy, but there will be more, there's no question about it. Because the offensive does not yet run its course. What is important to bear in mind is as far as the population of the country, 97% of the population of the country still under the top of the enemy's control. It's also to note that none of the refugees are moving north. All of them are moving south. It doesn't mean that the Guardian Committees have totally failed in their efforts to win the civilian population on their side. You see these pictures in the papers, they are accurate, of these refugees going from where they were opposed. If they like the communists so well and hated the South Vietnamese government so much, they'd be running into the RCM because going south, the North Vietnamese take over, they're going to get it. It's also to be noted that the North Vietnamese certainly have better discipline than the South Vietnamese, partly because they've been ahead of hunger, but partly because they use unprecedented terror. You've seen one of the stories in the man chain that hanged the rest. They use terror, they use all the brutality that perhaps used to be used in the armed forces of the United States, but you don't train people that way anymore. Try to get them to because they want to and so forth. But also there have been massive cases, and this is one of the reasons you saw yesterday that the people of Kuwait were on a on an emotional basis very ready to defend themselves because they remember the massacres in Kuwait in 1967. But there have been massive cases of North Vietnamese not only shelling citizens, after they come in and cut the throats, murdered all of those in the leader class who have opposed them. This is just, of course, a critical range of what can come in the future. There is no man that says it's better. What could happen in Georgia? Georgia's absolutely right. It's in the event, for example, that the United States now would pull away the air column, and Saudi Arabia would collapse. It would collapse in a matter of a week. If the event that would happen, what would happen to in South Vietnam? Would be similar to what happened in North Vietnam when the North Vietnamese took over in 1954. The Catholic Bishop of Da Nang estimated in his that 500,000, a half a million North Vietnamese Catholics, in this case who were included by some there, who would oppose the communists, were murdered or starved to death. Half a million. The massacre in a way is another indication. So it's quite different from my lay. To us, atrocities are wrong, and they should be, and they are prosecuted. To them, they get medals for it, because that is the way they're operating. Now, having stated all this, very sober, very analytical, this is a tough battle. It will continue to be a tough battle. The North Vietnamese still are offensive. However, they are suffering some enormous casualties. The South Vietnamese are fighting very well in some places, not so well in others, as would be anticipated with a relatively new army against an experienced army with better equipment. But we are providing an equalizer to the extent that we can, in massive air support and massive sea support. And let me say, those destroyers and carriers, taking destroyers, cruiser missiles we have out there doing them. Great job shelling those highways and predicting it to an extent. Now, the question as to how the battle is to come out is going to depend on which of the two sides can last. Whether the North Vietnamese can sustain this, and as Rogers Martin has already implied, that general weather is now coming, will become a factor in this area. Increasing next 2 to 3 weeks, the weather becomes an increasingly difficult factor for the offensive. It's also, of course, a factor against the air power, but it's a factor for the offensive, for motorized equipment in South Vietnam, because the weather becomes very difficult around 1st of June, throughout the month of June. So I think what we can say here now that this battle is going about as we anticipated. The South Vietnamese suffered some very significant losses. Some of their units have not performed well, others have performed heroically. The populace of town. And despite, of course, some pessimism that you might expect whenever they lose one provincial capital, the bottom itself, the economy is significant enough to know that not clock to the North Vietnamese side, the North Vietnamese is an armed citizen for that. As far as our air people, the community for concern, they've done a magnificent job, and they will continue to. As far as our attitude is concerned, it seems to me that our only choice is to continue to provide maximum care and see support to the South Vietnamese until the offensive runs its course. Once it runs its course, the North Vietnamese will be finished. They have struggled in Cambodia in 1970. They had trouble with their business involved, and they were badly mauled, and that was the year. In Laos in 1971, despite the fact that the end of the battle gave an indication of route and so forth, you will note that there was no further North Vietnamese action in 1971. Why? Because they used up their assets in the battle. Now it comes this year. This is different from Cambodia and Laos in the sense that the North Vietnamese have everything now. They know that this is their last possible. They have everything except one division, 325th, that he mentioned. It will now probably be medical. If, for example, Americans are still there, and we could put on an inch on landing, and it's been estimated that they could virtually walk into Hanoi. However, we're not there. And I come back to the basic point. There are no American ground forces. There will be none. There are his American air power. It will continue to be there. And as far as the targets in North Vietnam are concerned, at the present time, in the last 2 or 3 weeks, since our first strike on Hanoi, I was generally recommended that we battle area, we're doing that. However, as far as the general edifice of general policy is concerned, as long as the North Vietnamese continue their massive offensive in South Vietnam, all military targets in North Vietnam would be options for us to hit. And they will be hit. That's the way it's going to be. So that is their source of sand. Bad and good. The main thing for us to do is to, I must say, I very much appreciate the way our leadership, everybody around this table, George, Margaret, all of you, for stood up and said, don't be Pollyannish, don't underestimate the danger, don't underestimate the capability of the South Vietnamese to survive. Because the final analysis, I think one thing, the great weakness of the North Vietnamese is where they thought they would have their greatest strength. The people of South Vietnam, the one, how people without adequate armies can often be overtaken and overwhelmed by brutalized communist forces. And it's here that the role is being played. It's a close call. It's a close contest, but as far as you're concerned, we have no other choice. In my view, no other choice to do enormous consequences of extolling the support of communist invading of a small country to succeed. If we can prevent that, it's important to prevent it, and that's what we're trying to do. That's a summary, I think, that's pretty fair.
Yes, sir. Very, very good. But we are going to have difficult times. But the other side is going to have difficult times, too.
Oh, just one question. What success are you having in introducing anti-tank weapons into the infantry there? All right.
Well, the army, of course, has the law weapon, which is a short range position, which they use quite well. As a matter of fact, on occasion, they actually knocked out several tanks with 105 artillery. We have been in the process now of giving them the toll weapon also. I think I mentioned the fact that it's estimated that they've lost now, these days in North Vietnamese, about 300 tanks by a combination of the ground action as well as the air action and the ship action.
An indication of the North Vietnamese casualties is that the different fighters, they've got approximately 130,000 North Vietnamese regulars in South Vietnam. And this is quite a chunk. These are first line ground troops. An indication of the casualties is one intercept indicated that going up, back up to the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Laos, already there are fights. This is an article that 22,000 wounded already in that area, so we're going to take quite a bang too. The question is, who lasts the longer? But what about the Vietcong? I was on a program with the experts that surveillance that they're ready to unleash an attack of the Vietcong. Have the potential anymore to do more? The Vietcong, if I get the answer, because I think I don't have much money. The Vietcong, Bob. As per the question, we don't want to be a Vietcong. They're supposed to be the South Vietnamese guerrillas. This battle is being fought almost exclusively by North Vietnamese regulars. Now, they spent this in Jinjin province, we mentioned a moment ago, where the Vietcong have always been. It's a province of about 200,000 people. They've always been strong. And there is, since there are a significant number of Vietcong there. And down in the Delta, there are still pockets of Vietcong. But I think the Admiral would agree that our concern is not the Vietcong. The Vietcong are based on the assumption that the people of South Vietnam are ready to, drop out. That assumption is proven to be wrong. So it's a minimal factor, except in the Minden area and the Delta.
But that's correct. And I think that's one of the big differences between this activity and that situation. In such a state, you had the Vietcong generating uprisings in the city. And in addition to that, there are large percentage of the many portions of the North Vietnamese were actually manned by South Vietnamese. This time, as the President says, it's almost exclusively North Vietnamese, so when they lose a man, they lose a North Vietnamese, not a South Vietnamese, necessarily.
Is there any disintegration politically in Saigon or otherwise? Were there any major dissident groups who would organize to disrupt the government? Military operations.
We have indicated, President, that some of the followers of Big Men, was opposing to you and making comments critical of the government, and the same thing with a couple of the opposition that in the government, but I haven't seen any indications of any significance here. But there's been some of them, yes.
Not there as much as there was in our Civil War.
Yes.
Mr. President, you have a problem about negotiations, I'm sure, with the probability they can't sustain this over a long period of time. It would probably be a mistake to get too much involved in substantive negotiations while their offensive was at its peak. They're really looking for a strong position. And I can say, Barbara Jones, there's a general rule of warfare, which all of you are aware of. Only negotiating the conference table, which is a consequently, while we imagine our recruiting or negotiating track, I think we should assume that as far as hopes for negotiation are concerned, on any basis that would be fair to both sides, particularly to our side, those hopes do not become significant until the battle subsides, because if the enemy figures that it's going to, say, take away or something like that, they'll wait until they get that before talking. If, on the other hand, they figure that they're running out of gas, then they'll talk. But at the present time, as at the height of a battle, there's never negotiation that succeeds. You recall World War I, World War II, all of these, the negotiating track always must be kept open, either privately or publicly. But it never really produces anything until the battle is resolved in such a way, so that one side or the other recognizes that they are better off to negotiate than to fight. This point, believes that, I would say. I mean, negotiate something. I mean, we are negotiating. When I say that, discuss, as far as reaching a deal is concerned, as long when a battle is at its height, nobody makes a deal. And that's what we've got now. The battle's still very, very hot. Aren't they likely to take some negotiations just before they think better at it?
Well, they're watching for that, but I wouldn't anticipate so much. You're dealing here with a fanatical group of people. They've fought for 25 years. And they're always fighting in the hope that the South Vietnamese government may collapse. people's uprising, and actually in the hope that they'll get great support from what they thought were their friends in the United States. And I'm sorely disappointed at that today, because there hasn't been, of course, the support for their efforts in this country. There have been on previous occasions. Although there's been some.
Well, what do you think the mission of this particular offensive is? Is it to affect the peace talks? Do they really think they can come in and display this under South Vietnam?
Or what they want? What they want is what they always wanted. The goal was they headed, regardless of what kind of a deal they make now. They want to impose the communist government in South Vietnam. They're not going to stop them yet. Unless they find that militarily they're going to take it too much punishment to make it worthwhile. There again is one of the reasons why we have to continue hitting them in their heartland. They can't be a permanent sanctuary. Is there any guess as to how long we're going to have this meeting? Any guess on time?
Well, sir, as the President mentioned, we have the weather factor that will be coming in.
It's just the weather, but the Admiral also has said that it's a question of how long any offensive can go. You look at the great offensives in World War I, World War II. 4 weeks is about a few weeks to call. I mean, this may not be that well providing the rest. It was to say that next week is going to happen. But I think we're looking at, and the Admiral would agree, in terms of the impressive intensity, perhaps to say 3 or 4 weeks.
Yes, through May.
Through May. First of June, then weather plus just running out of gas. Supplies and the enormous attrition brings it in. So South Vietnamese have a problem of holding on to rest. The North Vietnamese have a problem of winning the war. They don't win, they lose. All South Vietnamese don't have to lose. They just have to prevent the North Vietnamese from winning. That, of course, is not your grand play yet. So we're in proper plans. But we must get on with some domestic matters, Admiral. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
I'll see you a little later.
Yes, sir. So, Mr. President, I have the gentleman here would like to see it. He's seeing the photograph of the Soviet equipment that's never been used before in South Vietnam. And I'll just leave you to see if they want to come by and take a look.
The Soviet has had 11 new types of weapons.
Just about, yes, sir. I think I have
them. That they had never used in South Vietnam before. Pretty formidable.
Mr. President, before the Admiral leaves, could I ask one more question? Well,
what does the shipping look like in Haiphong and Vien? Are the Soviets rushing in new equipment?
The shipping is at one of its highest levels. I'm in a 33 ship, I believe, in Haiphong now. The Soviets have been taking in about 200,000 tons a month. A large part of that during the last 3 months has been POL. And this is one of the reasons that we have been attacking the fuel supply, because obviously, due to the fact that they're using more motorized equipment in this effort, they had to lay in a backlog of fuel. But the tank equipment activity is quite heavy.
Thank you.
Yes.
We would like to go on before we go to the Senate House reports to some domestic matters, and John Ehrlichman has prepared again. This being three, I think, very effective for what I call one page, the story for some critical issues. John, if you'll describe them, which we will be distributing, and incidentally, we would appreciate the leaders, because of the helpful that we're going to send, and also sharing about our candidates and people. Sure.
question, what we received is, I think it's very interesting, the opinion research poll that came out that the reaction to your remarks, I think that's amazing, it was better 2-1 in favor of your position. I think that's very strong indication to support the public.
Well, that's all 70% actually said that, and it is my foot that the Department of Commerce military targets in our state, so these days, conversation stopped in the hall.
Where's it go?
The press didn't report that either. So, after medicine, you know, that's the problem. You want to press the report, whether you know what people think. It isn't the Washington Post this morning.
What's the price? The poll, because the hill yesterday, right?
Did it get up there?
Yep.
Just died right about a mile from Texas. Okay. This person, but it is, in the polls and so forth, and all the work. We all know this is a critical battle. Battles are lost, battles are lost, but I can assure you we're doing everything in the armed forces, mostly in the city. See, the South Vietnamese have the equalizer country, but it's not good. And these factions will be coming to you in increasing numbers. We'll send them directly to your offices and your colleagues' offices. There'll be about 20 of them in the first 30. The purpose of these, as if I can interrupt, the viewers, Bob Wilson will have the responsibility to let Johns or office or how do you need to your candidates. I mean,
we're going to send them out at a certain
time. Yeah, we'll provide them to you. We should not, obviously the White House should not send out such candidates. Of course, because you see you've got primary giving up.
Right.
So you then, when you get it back, you know everything. You can then reproduce it and send it out on your own. So that's how you do it.
Red Bluff on the Alabama front.
Well, did he?
Yeah.
Old days as well. I had this morning. 3-1. These are the things, these are problems that you get where people say, well, we don't know what the president's domestic accomplishments have been. So we're going to deal here mostly with hard facts, mostly with accomplishments. And you'll see that they're not only presidential accomplishments, but also congressional accomplishments. So there's something for everybody. I'd like to talk very quickly about the three in this order, inflation, crime, and unemployment. I give all your attention to the one on inflation and its impact on the economy because there will be several aspects of the economy. So the other here is fully done from all over the facts that have been verified that you can use. And of course, this business of the inflation changes. We're going to have some more numbers out on Friday. When those come out, we'll update this. You'll receive an updated version of some of these facts. And so now, you can confidently say the rate of inflation has been stopped cold. It has zero increase. Meat prices have leveled off. Fruit and vegetable prices have declined. Cost of consumer services has risen only by 0.2% for the second consecutive month. The inflation rate since the freeze, 2.8%, as you see in the graph at the bottom. But the really important number in this whole thing is under the heading wages. That's the second line. Real earnings for workers from 1970 to the present have gained 6%. Those are real in-pocket gains after inflation has taken out. So that the worker now is net dollars ahead for the first time since 1966.
For 5 years, workers thought they were getting wage increases. They didn't. Their wage increases were totally eaten up by prices. Now, by reason of our program, finally 80 million American workers have begun to get off the treadmill and make some progress. Now, of course, we'll have various people, some of the workers will say, we did better than that, and this is an average. But this shows that when it shows a 6% increase, in the terms real spendable earnings, it's quite a good measure to use if you're talking to an audience of conditions.
Now, just to give you an example, the graph at the bottom of the page is lifted right out of the budget documents. You remember when the budget came out of January, there was a book of charts called Budget Highlights. I encourage you all to use this book. Obviously, it spoke as of January. We'll try and update a lot of the numbers that are in here. But the graph you see at the bottom is this graph out of the budget highlights, updated. price index, which is a very favorable trend, and something that we encourage you to use and talk about. Let's turn quickly to the vaccine on crime. The number one paragraph deals with the crime rate locally in cities across the country, the national crime rate, and the D.C. crime rate. The reason that the D.C. crime rate is important is because this city is the only one in which the administration has direct linkage. In all the other cities across the country, we send the money out, but it's a question of local administration, local control, local application of the money. Administration, with the help of Congress and various reforms that have been passed, has direct linkage and has proved on a model city basis that you can achieve a net reduction in the crime rate. In fact, in the district, of course, the crime rate has been cut in half since this administration came into office. But over a third of our major cities in the United States have experienced net decreases in their local crime rates, and the national crime rate is the lowest in 6 years. So when you hear this business about this law and order administration not getting the results, here are the facts to put that phony line up. Now, the dollars that Congress has appropriated, I think, speak as loud as any other single factor. With the president's leadership, the amount of federal dollars applied to the crime problem in the United States has gone from $22 million in 3 years under the previous administration to $1.5 billion in 3 years under this administration. In other words, 22 against 1,500.
John, sir, I'm going to speak to this point. You make that point, it's altogether valid, but you invite your opponent to point out that there were only a few months remaining in the fiscal year just before the end of the Johnson administration in which the $22 million could be spent. So that's a dangerous fact.
Well, I think the important point here, Congressman Paul, is that there was no leadership in the last administration, that there wasn't any reason why this kind of a program couldn't have been applied to meet the problem 3 years before. But they fiddled around until the very end of that administration before they got this program with very strong Republican support, I might say, in the Congress. And that this administration and this Congress have very vigorously attacked this problem during the first 3 years of this administration. Now, I could bring it to your point, but you can take appropriations outside of LEAA as a specific program and ask them
up.
Did you get the same kind of
ratings? I agree, John. And in a similar context, making suggestions, you have to be careful with the phraseology when you speak of the crime rate. You just made a classic mistake. You said that the crime rate was lowest in 6 years. That is not correct. The crime rate increase is low.
Well, so it's 6 years. I think that's what I said, but if I didn't, I stand corrected.
What I intended to say.
What we're talking about here always is increase and decrease. We have experienced net decrease in the District of Columbia and in a third of the cities around the country. Nationally, we're still dealing with a net increase rate, and that net increase rate is below 6 years. If I didn't say it right, I should have. You know, it used to be like inflation. That's the best example because here, for the first month in 6 years, we had no increase in system justifications of the CPI. So the president, we're always talking about the rate of increase slowing rather than on whether inflation has been gone up or down. And the crime, as population increases, it's inevitable that crime is going up, and it's the rate of increase in crime that we're always talking about. If we can slow that, though, we're gaining on the problem. Being in the district, let me say, there is a flat cut in half of crime there, whereas the major crimes are running at 200. What's it, 200 a year?
22.
22. It's now less than 100. It's not that. Summarized at the bottom of that fact sheet are three important pieces of legislation that this Congress has enacted at the President's request. The third fact sheet on unemployment. I might greater gains. The gains that we have made are extraordinary, considering the great turnaround that we've had in this country from a defense and war economy to a peacetime economy. Many, many, many civilian jobs have been created. The fact sheet gives you those numbers. And you can talk either about employment, where the numbers are very, very good, or unemployment, where the numbers still aren't good enough. And you can run against unemployment, so to speak, by saying, we're not satisfied, it's still a task for this country, we're doing everything we know how to do, we're getting results, we're going to get better results in the future, and so you're not put in the position of apologizing for such and such a rate of unemployment in any particular moment of time. This summarizes, fact sheet summarizes the employment side, it summarizes the steps that are being taken on the unemployment side, and it was intended to be a foundation for whatever statistic or data that are in the due time. We don't say on the fact sheet, for obvious reasons, that the rhetorical strategy that we recommend is that you run against unemployment rather than try to defend a particular unemployment statistic. But that's the strategy. Well, you'll be seeing more of these fact sheets in the very short run. And if you do have suggestions for topics or if you have suggestions for improvement, we can bring them into account. Our criteria are that we give you only provable facts and that we keep it on one page. But beyond that, we're wide open to suggestions.
We'll all get up to some of your comments. So.
No, these would come to your office directly from here. The candidate will be receiving the same thing through Senator Dombrowski.
My candidate is that we're referring to candidates who are not in the
committee. No, it's
going to direct
that approach.
That's
the
people that are outside the chance to send them away. That Peter and Bob Wilson came on our side, expected to do what comes naturally.
These are very excellent, Mr. President, and
maybe more.
We'll get some better rhetoric. And they're very beneficial if you're going out to make a speech to have them available and use them for
I suggest on unemployment. John Connolly talked about extreme well on occasion. I mean, I wouldn't get caught. First, I think he talked about the policy that since the new economic policy is on, there's a million and a half jobs. Second, with regard to unemployment among breadwinners and so forth, it's low as any. The problem is new people in the labor market, and the people that have come out of the armed services and out of the defense lines, which is, should always be made, etc. Obviously, there are some issues with the labor market. I think it's very effective to those of you who can do this in some areas, and I think you should. As John Connors saying, today, you know, whenever you're in a large city, you might just pick up your newspaper and take along the help wanted ads, whether it's Los Angeles or Miami, New York, and the rest, you can find page of help wanted ads and you'll see unemployment. And I think you should make the point that part of the unemployment problem, not all part of the unemployment problem, is that there's this attitude of large people. They will not take a job if they consider their job to be menial. And this should not be the case. Their jobs will be menial. It doesn't make any sense to have help wanted ads at a very, very high level and unemployment at a high level. It's a, perhaps somewhat charged with demagoguery, but it's a fair point to make. And that also gets you the welfare attention. So,
Mr. President, you may be interested that we're putting these fact sheets into a loose leaf binder with indexed divisions and so forth of our speakers and having them available at our candidates conference next month. So.
Well, let's see. Did we get a brief report from the Senate and House today? Well, in the House of Representatives, we have another rather slow week this week. It's anticipated, however, that revenue sharing will get a rule probably next week sometime. And it'll be on the floor of the House either the week of the 15th, which is a week from Monday, or the 22nd, which is the following week. I think it will pass the House with a very substantial margin. It's not alleged on the part of the opposition that it's your program. It has a different title and slightly different substance, but basically it's our revenue sharing bill. As I said, I think we're not without too much trouble. We also have, before the Rules Committee now, and a rule probably will be granted, the minimum wage legislation. Committee reported out, typically of that committee, a very bad legislation. It not only goes to $2 immediately, but it includes about five extra provisions for extended coverage, all of which are bad. There's one that is a very definite protectionist provision. It's our strategy to come up with a substitute. John Irwin Board will offer the substitute, calls for a straight $2 increase, and it knocks out all of the extended coverage, including the protectionist provision. It does, however, add a provision which we think is very desirable for use differential. The argument always is minimum wage increases knock out the job opportunities for younger people. We allegedly have in the law now a use differential, but it's rather meaningless. The early-born substitute will have a really beneficial use differential. Now, we've been trying to get John Erlenborn to reduce his $2 figure, but John's stuck with it. John Anderson's going to offer an amendment to the substitute to take the increase from $1.60 to $1.80, and then 12 months later on,
$2.60.
$2.60.
We've always done before whenever we've had increases. We face it in rather than going to the top figure.
Now, we've taken a whip check to see whether our members would support John Anderson's substitute or amendment to the Erlenborn substitute. The whip check is encouraging, but certainly it means we've got some work to do if we're going to get the amendment to prevail. We are negotiating with some friends on the other side, trying to convince them that the Anderson Amendment is desirable. It'll be a very close vote on that.
The only thing I would strongly urge here, just to be sure you have time for a veto, because this is one of the questions about what the...
Well,
so if you want to, you need the assurances on our side as to what's going to happen. You'll have to be so they go to them.
Well, I think many of us, including myself, if we are unsuccessful in our substitute or Anderson Amendment, many of us will vote against the committee bill. It's really bad legislation. I guess the Senate committee has...
will be worse.
It's gone much worse than the Queen. So,
I just want to say it before you did.
But those two are the major proposals that will come before the House prior to the Memorial Day weekend recess. After that, we hope to have the first, probably the only, reorganization proposal, the one that Chef Hollowfield has been working quite conscientiously on. If we could get the community development reorganization plan through the House, that's pretty good progress. The rest of them are so controversial, I don't think they're really going to be done in 1972. Health insurance, John Burns reported to me yesterday that he thinks it's doubtful if we had any action in 1972. John was optimistic about some action in private pension field in 1972. On the House side, at least, and I can't speak for the Senate, but John Burns thinks there is a chance on the House side for such action. Other than these particular measures, I would say that
in committee on appropriations is about ready to move on a number of those appropriation bills, and I'm told on the Senate side that we're in pretty good shape once we just come over there. This may move more rapidly than is apparent at this time. We have the authorization bill for the Department of Defense. They had several critical votes yesterday. The mess isn't here now, but they defeated a NEDSI proposal, which was a typical Mansfield type. That will come to the floor of the House probably after Memorial Day. We'll have to go to the Rules Committee, and the time is getting short. Perhaps the military situation will be clarified, and I suspect, I don't think this will come to the floor of the House before the 1st of June.
Oh, that's fine.
Yes, we'll either be way ahead or we'll be in trouble. So I think there shouldn't be any hurry on our part to expedite this particular bill.
Could I suggest one thing, Mr. Chairman? The leaders and so forth, I know you have these problems with regard to the war, the resolution, and so forth and so on. At this critical point, as you know, us pursuing the negotiating track as well as the time of decision for South Vietnam as their DC Mark Vietnam, for the Congress to undercut the president would, in my view, completely destroy our negotiating position and would lead to, it would destroy the president's negotiating position, and the Congress would have to take responsibility for the destruction of our negotiating position at this point in particular. The enemy is looking for that, and I've taken a strong hand. Actually, they follow the ORC poll, but they know that the Congress can tie the president's hand. When the Congress takes the position, it will undercut the negotiating position. It will give the enemy enormous encouragement. It could be the critical factor in destroying and weakening the South Vietnamese will to resist. So, I think you put it right in line. Those are the facts.
We had one vote last week. Our friend Bella Abzug brought up another resolution demanding certain facts on bombing, etc. And we got, I think, 270 to 113, something of that sort. So if that was any indication, I think we'll be in as good shape in the House in the future, and we have some of that. That's about where we are legislating in the House, Mr. President.
But I also suggested for both the House and the Senate, despite the fact that you did not expect to get results, keep hammering for the busing moratorium, keep hammering for it, because that will be a critical issue as time goes on.
I might make a comment on that. We are continuing to try and get people to sign the discharge petition, and I know four or five who are about to do it and will sometime this week. Once you get over that 170 mark, then the whole
thing
starts to go on its own. We're also opening negotiations with Bill Comer to see if we can't get the Rules Committee to take away from the House Committee on Education and Labor that legislation, which they are obviously not going to act on.
Mr. President, very considered flawed House that has taken a while over the Senate. We listened to Mr. Rebell for 5 hours yesterday, and the injunction of secrecy wasn't lifted, so considering Mr. Andrew Jack Anderson's excessive information, I can't.
nothing to report anyway about what happened yesterday in that secret session. I mentioned a lot of in the room here would be, we're sorry to hear about Senator Fulbright's setback earlier in the week when he only got 15 votes on his executive custody. And we had all the Republicans except one voting with us on that. That was the beginning, of course, of the fight on the State Department USI authorization bill, which is now before us. And the pending business is the amendment by John Stennis to strike out what's referred to as the church language in the bill, reported by the committee, which would end all U.S. funding for all military operations in Indochina by the end of the year. With the support of Georgia Senator John Cooper and others running now, frankly, we think we've got the votes to win the Senate amendment if we can get it to a vote. Unfortunately, I think the vote would be a little closer than I would like to see, but I think we've got the votes. We're going to try to get to a vote this week. If we could get that to a vote, I think we're then going to be faced, however, with the Ministry of Amendment Ultimatum, which will be offered by Byrd this week if we get that far, or by Mansfield next week. Once we get by the end of the war votes, I think we'll quickly be able to wind up that State Department USI authorization bill. And then the next thing on the calendar is Clinton's nomination. We're going to start working on that today, but I think that's a good change to just get to a vote.
Well, there's one thing that I should have mentioned. Did you know the Democrats had a caucus about 10 days ago, and after a very bloody two-day battle, they came up with a directive to Doc Morgan, chairman of the Committee on Foreign Affairs, to report out legislation that would conform to their caucus action. Bill Maillard is here. Maybe Bill could give us a brief of what he thinks that committee would do or will do on that legislation.
Well, I've been in California for about 4 days, so I didn't get to talk to Doc, but I did talk to him just before I left. He was then trying to cast around for some way or other, not complying, but he just sort of knows exactly how he's going to do it.
You're fine. You know, Wayne Hayes, who's not often our ally,
nobody is, is good.
If you say when he is, he's fine, told me that he was going to do everything he could to thwart any action in their committee. Now, he's a pretty agile, imaginative fellow when he feels that way. So maybe we've got an ally that can help us, even though most of us don't like what he does often.
USI opposition bill, of course, came out of the Foreign Agency Committee, maybe George Aiken have something to add about what the situation is and whether I assess it correctly.
Well, I have got to add to that. I think that the church case amendment can be stricken out. In fact, one of the sponsors of that objection. Most wishes to him never got on in the first place. And then I understand they will offer the Mansfield Amendment. Whether that fixes a date or not, if it fixes a date for a spouse of Congress, that's something the other day that is a vote of confidence amendment. If it calls on him to fix a date sometime under certain conditions, it might approved. I'm not sure about that. But certainly, we have to thank the trustees of East Spencer in Russia for the one-sided vote the other day at 2015. And that's all. And incidentally, Russia's stock is not going up very high.
President, I hope you'll keep encouraging the Vice President to take off and do nothing counterproductive. I was very encouraged by his reports this morning. And this is a good way to attack on this letter.
Pretty long lines of surgery.
I don't think that he needs to be encouraged.
That position and the confirmation and the
time. Out of a partisan political debate in an election year, I have found that by checking the law, that in the event of the incapacity of the director to operate, the Attorney General has the right to appoint an acting director for a period of time, which is unlimited. And consequently, I have authorized claims to make an appointment of an acting director, reconsider a director, and it will be announced today that the President will, I will set forth these facts about the need that the director of the FBI, who is such a presidential appointment, will be appointed after the election by, of course, whoever is president at that point, the elected president, if not after the election, and his name be submitted to the Senate for confirmation then. Otherwise, you see what could happen. What could happen? We could appoint a director now. I could appoint, shall we say, beyond recruit the greatest law enforcement officer in the world, and it would get into a bitter partisan debate down there in the Senate, within the Bureau would be in turmoil up until November, and after November, when his name would have to be, incidentally, just like an appointment to the Supreme Court, he has to submit his resignation the minute the election occurs. And a new president, if it did not happen to be me, would put in somebody else. We cannot have it that way, so the decision that I made is that we will have an acting director, which will not be submitted to the president. Does not need to be. He will be a good man, I'm sure. He will serve through November. And then, after November, when the political winds cool down, in the great tradition in which Hoover was appointed, he will appoint the best man to find the job at that point. But that's the decision I made, and I trust that you will all support it.
But I think it's bad to steal their ammunition that way.
It's why a lot of the time, if you make an appointment now, you can't have such a wonderful time.
No, I had thought that might be the problem that you raised, Gary, but I know you, with your experience, would see that. But,
Mr. President,
I can. Yeah, excuse me, Mr.
I can see some problems in that mission of lady duck philosophy. I don't think you're in the position that Lyndon Johnson was when the LSC wasn't going to run again.
Well, it is a Supreme Court nomination. You see, if it were a Supreme Court nomination, there'd be no question. Send it right now. And of course, the cabinet, I'm going to have the cabinet, send it right now. But you see, this is a very special appointment. The director of the FBI should serve through administration after administration. It should have continuity. And it shouldn't be subject to a political change. That's why, for example, when Hoover came in after my election, submitted his resignation, he knows that I reappointed him. Of course, I would have because of my personal respect and affection for him. But I didn't consider there was any choice because I said that I just felt that under the circumstances, it shouldn't be treated as one of those political plots like the others. No, I realize the problem, but I think we have to distinguish this position from the others. Sure, the Senate will confirm, but we're sure that they get quite under the Griffin rule. No. The Griffin rule, you have confirmed it.
Well, as I said, I'm under Johnson. He said he wasn't going to run again, so this is
the right. Well, it's a different situation. Can't you imagine what kind of investigation they have, not of the appointee, but of the FBI?
Mr. President, I want to address the candidate. Chairman Seller is planning to introduce legislation to establish a blue-ribbon commission to investigate the FBI this week.
Was that announcement? Was that planned before the director's desk?
No. We were waiting on an opportune moment to make this decision.
Well, it's been investigated before. I'm going to see what happens. It's a little late. I must say that I again want to close this meeting by saying that as I was in Texas the other day,
great difference in what you had for the years, all of you, in this period. I know it's a hard time for you. I know you pick up headlines, look at the television, and my God,
don't beat it up too much.